Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the Modern Learners Podcast. If you're someone who's in a position of educational leadership or who someday aspires to be, and you enjoy diving deep into learning and innovation, we invite you to join us in Modern Learners' newest community, Change Leaders. I'm Lynn Hilt, the community manager of CLC, and our space can help ensure you're using your professional learning time to the fullest. CLC offers carefully curated content to help you find signal among the noise, thought-provoking questions and discussions with inspiring community members who are serious about change, live events and access to the Modern Learners team, and a circle of critical friends who will help you kick off change efforts in your schools. Visit changeleaders.community to check out a free 30-day trial and join in our movement. And I look forward to learning with you.
And welcome to the Modern Learners Podcast. I'm Will Richardson, your host, and you are listening to episode number 36, believe it or not. Time is just flying by. In this episode, my good friend and colleague Bruce Dixon and I are back at it again. We're getting all existential and profound, or at least trying to, as we try to figure out the artistry of teaching, which was the topic of our latest Shifting Conversations blog post. And also why it's so hard for schools to think about change at a really serious level. And that's something I've been thinking more about since having a really profound moment of learning when I was in South Africa last week. Pretty sure this episode will get you thinking as well. Don't forget to connect with us at modernlearners.com, at change.school, changeleaders.community, which are all places where we are reimagining schools for a new era of learning. And as always, if you like this podcast, why not head over to iTunes and give us a quick review? And please tell your friends to subscribe using their favorite podcasting app. But for now, here's 40 more minutes on some of the bigger challenges we're facing in schools. And as always, thanks for listening.
And we're back. How are you, Bruce?
I'm very well. Will, I'm back. I haven't been anywhere, but you have.
Yes, I think as I said to someone today, I think my brain and my body are in the same time zone for once in the last week or so. A little bit of a different time place, but
so was it getting back there. 14-hour, 16-hour flight?
16-hour flight from Johannesburg, 7-hour time difference, which I'm not sure I ever really got onto, to be honest. I did not have a lot of sleep. Yeah, I slept a lot there on the flight. But yeah, good to be back. And you're in the middle of like a really bad storm right now. So this is always
it's our summer. It's a bit of a summer storm, and it isn't the edge of the cyclones that are running around the top of this country. But no, it's very windy here. So hopefully our power goes through this podcast and live stream. And anyway, it's good to have you back in the country.
And don't drop off so I have to carry through this whole podcast by myself, because people will definitely fall asleep if that's the case. But
so I was really interested in post last week, the artistry of teaching. I thought it was a beauty.
Well, you know, as longtime listeners know, I love that phrase, right? This is podcast 36, so I guess we're up into longtime territory. And thank you for watching and listening if you're on Facebook right now, and appreciate you coming back and watching later if you're not here at the moment. But so we're huge fans of Seymour Saracen. And, you know, every now and then I get a kind of a urge to remind myself of Seymour's great intelligence and his sense of what's important in the world of learning and education. So yeah. I thought it was a good time just to revisit a little bit of his thinking and go back to talk more about what productive learning is and what those contexts are. And every time he's one of those people where every time I read him, I get a little bit more out of it, and he pushes my thinking. You know what I'm saying? And I carry that book with me. It's in my backpack. It's like wherever I go. And if I have a couple minutes and I'm not online or whatever, I just kind of pull it out and just open it up to a page and read. So, but what I thought was interesting is once again, his point that it's not about where we are, it's about where the kids are. And this isn't rocket science. And I think everyone understands why it's important to start where the kids are. But again, the irony of schools is that we make kids start where we are.
Yep.
And this idea that the real artistry now in terms of teaching is to figure out how to take their bliss, their passion, and connect it to the stuff that we want in terms of, you know, having them meet our standards, the ones at least that we think are most important. So,
but what got to me about the post and about the quote and what you've just said is that as often happens when you're reading particularly Saracen, He gets to the absolute heart of the issue. You know, people might have seen the your heading on that and said, the artistry of teaching, oh, how cute, oh, how beautiful. And they get a warm glow in their heart and they'd say, oh, Will's saying we're artists. Isn't that lovely? And everyone gets very excited and warmed up about it. Forget all the warmness and whatever else. You've got to really think about what is he actually saying here. And this one, I said to you before we started, I thought this one quote encapsulated so much, if not everything, that we're trying to do in modern learners and in change school and change leaders. You know, he just says it so succinctly. And I think that's part of the problem. He's so articulate and succinct in what he says that people, you know, sometimes miss the point of it all. And, you know, he said, you know, this makes the goal in education, if not achieved, makes the achievement of all other goals very unlikely. I won't read the whole quote, but we'll just break it up because I think it's worth doing that. That goal is to create those conditions that make students want to learn, not have to learn, but want to learn more about self, others, and the world. Now, that's it. Full stop. And you go, okay, let's work on that. Let's riff off that for a few months in our school and let's start talking about what the implications are of what he said in that one sentence.
Well, you know, what's most profound to me about Saracen has always been the distinction between, or the definition of productive learning as being wanting to learn more. It's just so true, and all of us know it. You know, the things that we've learned most deeply are the things we've wanted to learn more about. The things that we don't want to learn more about, we don't really learn them for the long term. They don't stick. It's unproductive, I think, is a great word. But the other thing about Saracen, too, that is interesting to me is that, I mean, there's no question that he values the role of the teacher in this interaction. Mm-hmm. So as much as he says that it's about letting kids learn the things that they want to learn and putting the emphasis on their interests and passions, the role of the teacher is twofold, not only to create those conditions where that happens, right? To build the trust, the culture, the provide the agency, all that kind of stuff. But then the line in here that really gets to me is where he says, that is to say, you seek to help the child forge connections between what he or she wants to know and what the child needs to learn, right? And it's that needs to learn part.
That's it.
Yeah, that needs to learn part that is about, you know, what our role as teachers is.
That's it. Absolutely.
And the problem is, though, we start with what we think the needs to know part is, right? Or needs to learn part is. And all Saracen's saying is, no. We can't do that. We have to start with them and then figure out how to map their interests to our outcomes.
And you're highlighting two points. Firstly, people have a debate about one or the other. Oh, no, you can't let the kids do everything they like. Or, well, maybe it's not our job to tell them everything they should do. And they think on those extremes rather than looking, as he said, and this is why he uses the word genuinely, artistry. He says, I say artistry because those connections cannot be forged by a fiat that requires the child to conform to a predetermined or calendar-driven program. You can teach by the calendar. You cannot productively learn by the calendar. This is not permissiveness or a mindless indulgent of a child's whims and fantasies, and fancies, I should say. It is a way of hooking the child, enlarging the child's view in line with the maxim that the more you know, the more you need to know. That's it. He talks about that, and that word artistry is the right word. And I've, you know, my clumsy old language is always, you know, I've leaned back on that art and science of teaching and learning. And I think the word, you know, the way he expresses it here is so much more succinct and to the point. And it's as you started by saying there, we need to have that starting point and we need to work on it. But it doesn't mean we just let the kids run wild and cross our fingers, and doesn't mean we've lost our role in the class. It actually, the point about all this and the point about everything we do in modern learners and change school and change leaders is it increases the role of the teacher, because it requires so much more nuance and subtlety about that role.
Well, it's a more complex role on the part of the adult.
Yep.
And, you know, one of the comments that I made in that post, too, is that when most people think of the art of teaching, I think what they really think of is, how do I teach in a way that makes kids engaged in the stuff that I want them to learn?
Yep.
you know, I mean, I talked a little bit about when I was a classroom teacher, how I went out of my way to try to make this really irrelevant, boring crap of a curriculum.
What was the book? It sounded really exciting.
Yeah, Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
I couldn't wait to pick it up after you posted it.
It was a sermon, and it was just such a great example. But, you know, a sermon that he delivered back in the 1600s, and basically, the only reason we taught it, was because it was in the anthology text. That's it. If it was in the text, you know what I mean? Someone else chose it. It wasn't even like we chose that. You know, someone else looked at all of the potential things that anybody could read from the 1600s, selected that one, and then we selected that text. So you know what I mean? It's like one level removed even from and so here I'm really working hard to try to make someone else's choice interesting to my kids, and that's where the whole thing just loses the plot, right? But it's just kind of funny when you step back and think about how much effort we expend trying to get kids engaged in stuff that they're just not engaged with, and they're not going to be. And they might do it. They might kind of tap into it for a while to make us feel better. Or we might be successful in some cases.
But extend that a little bit, because it comes back to Gary Steiger's quote, which is one that sort of, I guess, peers into that edge and says, you know, the role of school, the role of our role in school for kids is to also expose them to things they may not know they're interested or have a passion for. And that's absolute. Now, in its extreme, of course, that's what you were doing, right? In its extreme, you're not going to decide. Some group of committee of 10 sitting over in some building decided that that was one of the books they should be exposed to because they're going to get excited about it.
Right.
It's somewhere in there, it's balance.
Yeah, and I think the other... not problem, but well, the other piece of it is, of course, that, you know, we'd been teaching out of that anthology for 20 years, you know, so it wasn't like even, you know what I'm saying, right? I don't need to go down that path, but it's just kind of interesting that we work so hard when we don't really have to. I mean, if the emphasis on what we do in schools is about but developing or nurturing kids to become lovers of learning. And we say this all the time. We want kids to be lifelong learners. Well, yeah, then let's just maintain that. And let's keep that in, let's just build on what they already bring in terms of when they're 5 years old, they've been lifelong learners, you know, when they're 6 years old, 7 years old, they've been lifelong learners. But then we just change the equation on them. And we talked about this so much, but I just want to kind of connect this to my trip to South Africa, which was fascinating. And it was a really interesting mix of speakers. They weren't necessarily educators. They were psychologists, and they were talking a lot about just helping kids with stress and anxiety. It was a very emotional, social, emotional kind of.
Yeah, just put it in context, you were working with a school or a group of schools?
Well, it was a conference. It was a symposium. That's what they called it. So they had five speakers there, and I was one of them. And it was a 3-day thing, and it was pretty intense, I have to say. They worked me really hard, but it was great. I mean, it was a group of people, about 150 people or so, that wanted to learn more, right? So it's not like I had to work that hard to engage them, because they chose to come to this and they pretty much knew what was going on. But, you know, there was a question. They had the five of us on a panel at the very, very end. And there was a question that the audience had come up with, which was basically, if there was one thing that you would do moving forward to really make schools the types of places that they could be and that would serve kids best given this moment, you know, what would that be? And I said, I said two things that Saracen goes back to, this whole idea about Saracen. The first thing I said was, why shouldn't schools be places of fun and of joy for kids? I mean, I think if we made our effort to help kids be joyful when they're with us, that would solve a lot of our issues, you know? And the other piece of it was, because they were talking a lot about anxiety and stress and you know, I think that would alleviate a lot of that anxiety and stress because it would honor the kids and who they are. But the other piece of it too was, you know, why aren't schools, and Chris Layman says this all the time, and lots of people have said this, Dewey have said this all the time, but why aren't schools, if we want kids to be lifelong learners.
Sorry, I've got to say, I love the way you threw Chris Layman and John Dewey together there. Chris would be flattered.
Well, but if, you know, if we want kids to be lifelong learners in the real world, why aren't schools the real world? I mean, Why is it that so much of what we do in classrooms has so little to do with what happens in real life? Why can't we make classrooms real life and, you know, have kids interacting in the world in ways that make sense to them around the things they care about? You're producing another podcast.
Yep.
That will be in this mix at some point with Peter Hutton from Templestowe College. Yep. Down in, yep. You know, down in your neck of the woods. And I mean, you can talk a little bit about that too. You know, you mentioned the other day that when you visited there, there were kids making skateboards.
Yep.
And doing all sorts of stuff like that. So, yep. I mean, it just goes back again, and I kind of wandering a little bit here, but it just goes back again to this idea that we know what we should be doing, but we're so kind of embedded in this practice that starts with us that it makes it difficult for us to even understand how to start with kids.
Yeah, I want to ask you then why you think we aren't ready for that change or we're not making that change. But before I do, large numbers of schools that are trying to tackle that head on, of course, are big picture schools. And I think many of our listeners and viewers would be familiar with that work. And I think that, you know, they're a classic example of someone who's straight out said, right, we want these kids to be embedded in the real world. We want their work to relate to something that has meaning for them, that's authentic. And that's certainly what they're about. And the irony of me referencing Big Picture was, as you know, we're going to release another white paper shortly around assessment. And I thought one of the classic quotes from Dennis Liedtke, who was one of the co-founders of Big Picture Schools. And he put it very simply, coming back to our comment about Saracen as well. What if we assess students' learning by measuring whether it made them want to learn more? You know, yeah. I mean, goodness gracious.
Yeah. And I think if kids are working on real world issues and real world things that they care about, then they want to learn more. Yep. They want to solve those problems.
Because it has meaning to them, and that's meaning for them. And that's the whole point. And so why do you think, what's the barrier to this? And what were the discussions that you had down in South Africa that sort of helped inform you about some of the background of those decisions?
Certainly one of the most interesting and profound moments I had down there, and it was probably one of the most profound moments I've had in a while, actually, was listening to a guy by the name of David Gleason, who wrote a book, At What Cost, which both of us are, of course, now kind of diving into, of course. And honestly, I'd love to have I emailed him today, and I'd love to have a podcast with him.
Yeah, it'd be good if we could.
I found him just fascinating. So, you know, you and I, and again, in our work, with Missy and others, we've been trying to kind of point out the gap between what we know and what we do. Here's our weekly mention of Russell Acuff. We're trying to do the wrong thing right. And how kind of interesting it is when you get people to realize that, to kind of own up to that and say, yeah, that is what we believe. And yeah, that is what we do. And the two don't really look much alike.
There's a big gap.
You know, we've got to figure out what that means. Well, David put it in a way that just kind of raised it to a new level for me. And again, he's talking primarily around the context of, as a school psychologist and as someone who works with a lot of schools around social emotional learning, but in the context of how many kids are stressed, how many kids are depressed, how many kids feel anxious, how many kids exhibit suicidal tendencies in regard not to just what's happening in school, but in other parts of their lives, but all kind of centered around this idea of achievement and about, you know, living up to these expectations, in many cases, these unrealistic expectations that we have for kids. And basically in his work, what he did, he talked about how he has gone around to lots of independent schools and international schools and engaged people in those schools in conversations around what are some of the things that you see kids presenting with. And that's, they all say, kids are stressed, kids are anxious, kids are trying to live up to these unreasonable expectations. And basically, then he asked them, well, why do you think that's happening? And they all go, well, because we put too much emphasis on the test, because we assign too much homework, because they're overscheduled, because da 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 da. And then he says, well, what do you think could fix that? And they all say, well, pretty much we could assign less homework. We could take away some of that grading stuff. We could give them a lot of fewer things to worry about, et cetera. There are solutions to that. And then basically, he asked, well, why don't you do that? And that's where it got really interesting to me, because when he started reading the responses of people as to why they didn't do what they knew was the right thing to do, they said things like, because if we cut back on all of the stuff that we ask kids to do, we won't be seen as rigorous anymore. Yeah. College. We'll be seen as soft. Soft.
The fourth R, rigor.
and all these other things, their fears were literally existential. That if they did the right thing for kids,
yep.
I mean, I don't think I'm missing it here when I sum it up this way. If we did the right things for kids that we know in our hearts we should be doing, we would lose our jobs.
When they say people would view them as being soft, what do you think they meant?
Well, I think that
what they really mean.
What they really mean is that parents' expectations are not in line either with what, you know, what we know would be the right thing to do for kids. And probably to some extent, too, college admissions officers' expectations would not align. I mean, you know, this goes back to the podcast we did with Scott Looney.
Yep.
And how basically getting rid of grades is a huge, huge thing for college admissions officers to wrap yep. their brains around.
Yep.
So I think that you have to just come to the conclusion that the narrative of school and the expectations we have of kids is so deeply ingrained and embedded in our just life, in our lives, right? In the way we talk about it, the way we think about it, the way it manifests itself, that we've really gotten to the point now where even though we know kids are literally dying because of the undue amount of stress that we put on them, we can't change it because we feel like we may lose our job or we may, you know.
So do you think that perception about softness, because we both know that, you know, that would reinforce our observations from discussions in the various forums we're working. Is that because there is a completely fanciful or mystical view about what the realities of the world are? What you know, we need kids who are rigorous and hardcore or something to face the world of work, you know, that if they're not doing complex work that's really hard and they're not barking at words and numbers on a page and memorizing them and doing it every night and day for long periods of time and forcing them to do this, then they'll never stand up to the rigors of work. Is it associated with that, of course, the rigors of higher education? And to what extent, how do they frame that? Because I'll just loop over higher education for a second, because that's not my view of what work's like at all. I mean, if you get the average person in the street and you say, tell me what you do, and they talked about their job, okay, they vary greatly. A large number of people might have physically challenging work. Some people might have particularly monotonous work. But the vast majority of people in their employment are doing work that they choose to do. Many, if not most of them, are doing the sort of work that they enjoy doing. And I don't get a sense that the large numbers of them, you know, are sort of sitting around burdened with them in the way that we are burdening kids in schools. I mean, the extent to which this fourth R, rigor, is demanding people take this hardcore approach to what we should be doing in schools is completely unrealistic and artificial. And I think that it comes back to the challenge we have about the narrative of school, about how do we tell the story about what is happening in school and why. And it gives us a big challenge because people have built up this view that if kids don't come out, almost, dare I say, it goes back to the early days, if they don't come out with military readiness, you know, a military readiness for bloody learning, excuse my language, you know, they're not going to learn. Where in fact, the exact opposite is the case. So why are we so far... Why are we so far away from the mark? We both know that in those schools where we've had the good fortune, the very good fortune of working with teachers and kids who are sort of approaching this, we'll call it the Saracenite type of learning environments, where kids are making their choices, where the artistry of teaching is on show, where there is that balance between what they want to learn and what they need to learn. And that balance is sort of orchestrated by a teacher in the room, teachers in the school who understand the nuance and subtlety of that. Those are the kids who are going to make profound contributions to our world. Those are the kids who are free and open thinkers. They're the kids who have confidence in themselves, who have they see themselves as productive learners. So the contradiction is, it's black and white. On one side, we're almost going in the opposite direction Whereas the reality is we want kids who are adaptable, flexible, and lifelong learners. And everything we're doing, so this rigor, this hardness, this, you know, lack of being too soft, mitigates against the kids ever being like that.
You know, there's not a person listening to this or a person that we'll ever come into contact with that doesn't know someone who's happy, healthy, successful, is doing great work in the world, that has taken a totally different path from the one that we've just talked about, that hasn't done that whole college thing, hasn't done that whole race to the top of the grades thing. You know what I'm saying, right? Everybody knows that there are different paths to success, that there is no one particular path that works for everyone. But, you know, when you ask the question, so why are we here today? Well, let's be honest. There are a lot of people who've made tons and tons and tons of money on promoting the story that says, if you want to do well in your when you're an adult, if you want to be successful, and I use air quotes because that's an interesting definition as well when you ask people what successful means. If you want to be successful in that frame, then you have to get good grades. You have to score well on these tests. You have to go to these colleges. You have to blah, 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 blah. And we bought it. The world has just swallowed that line, hook, line, and sinker. And there are a lot of people whose livelihoods depend on the maintenance of that narrative.
But by the way, there hasn't been much alternative to that narrative available to many people.
Well, but there's also been, you know, that narrative is also, let's be honest, only available to a certain select group of people, right? You know, this is the Western upper middle class narrative that everyone aspires to. And I get the idea that an education is something that is important, that we want our kids to be educated, that we want our kids to have experiences as they grow up that will prepare them for the world that they're going to live in. All of us want that. But the question now is schooling really doing that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we talk about this all the time. And I just do think we are at an inflection point where this conversation, we talked about this earlier today, this conversation is now becoming more prevalent in schools. I mean, everybody who I was with this weekend down in Johannesburg was like, we need to have a different conversation. There's a sense that says we are not doing what's right. Finally, we are not doing what's right. And so we have to figure out what right means right now.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you take what you were just saying then further, it explains while we might be working with groups of people in the work that we do and in the forum, the symposium you were doing it, and in various conferences, discussions around the world, there is a movement, there is an energy towards rethinking and reimagining what school could and should be. And while that's going on, and it's certainly growing, there's no question about that, we do see now a lot of less informed initiatives coming from outside education, which are also trying to tackle the problem. So they are businessmen, celebrities, and we won't name them, but we know that there has been tens of millions of dollars now poured into these initiatives, which at one level you want to support the fact that they're saying we need alternatives, that we need a different path, a different narrative. You want to say, look, congratulations, we agree that what we're doing now isn't working, but unfortunately, so many of those initiatives aren't making reference to the learning professionals, to educators in what they're designing. And they're really distracting from the worldwide movement that we're talking about, because often they're, as I said, well-intentioned, well-funded, and very significant, very high profile. As I said, when they've involved, particularly technology entrepreneurs, you know, they've been able to get a lot of publicity, even though a school like Ad Astra, which is Elon Musk's investment, tries very hard to stay under the sheets. But I think it's interesting that on both sides, whether it's this not so well-informed but well-intentioned and well-funded initiatives that are getting high profile, or whether it's what we know is a groundswell of movement amongst educators today, they're both saying what we have today isn't what our kids need.
Right. So there's an interesting article in Fast Company that I found today that I'll make sure it gets put in the show notes. But the headline is, this school focuses on teaching students happiness, not math. right? So this is a school in India by some entrepreneurs who are starting a new school, so fairly small. But I'm just going to read this quote, and then I want to make a point about it in light of what you just said. So this is a quote from the founders, one of the founders. He says, "It's our view that happiness or emotional intelligence or balance or confidence or self-esteem or any other word for feeling good about ourselves and our place in the world is the foundation on which great lives and great achievements are built." So first of all, I don't think there's anyone in the world who, if you flip that sentence, would say, "It's our view that unhappiness, lack of emotional intelligence, imbalance, lack of confidence, lack of self-esteem is what's going to lead to great achievement." So nobody's going to argue with the fact that if you're going to be successful in whatever form that takes, if you're going to make great achievements happen, live great lives, you have to have those things.
Yep.
And then they say, you know, if you think of typical schools, the priority is knowledge acquisition, cramming kids' heads with information, then skills. And if you're lucky, maybe your school cares about your personality and character and what type of person you are.
Yep.
But we wanted to flip this. We're going to focus first and most on students' character and personality. We want to cultivate happy kids, compassionate people, people that are going to go out into the world and do something good.
Mm-hmm.
This is not rocket science. It's not rocket science. You cannot, kids who are unhappy, stressed, anxious, disengaged, bored, whatever, are going to have a harder time of going out and making a difference in the world than kids who are happy, have self-esteem, feel confident in their abilities. You know what I'm saying.
But don't you think a lot of people, particularly in fast company, would read that and say soft? That's
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, part of the point.
Yeah.
Well, we can't do that. We just couldn't do that because we would be risking A, B, C, D, you know, all this stuff, college and rigor and all that kind of stuff. But it just speaks to this point that I made a little bit earlier that I think these kinds of conversations, whether they're from entrepreneurs now or whether they're from people in schools who want to change them, whatever else, I think a lot more people are coming around to this idea that we're not doing the right thing. And look, I mean, it's hard for people to hear that, but I've gotten to the point now in my life and career, and I think you're at the same place where that's the starting point. Hey, let's get on the same page here. We can do stuff to make kids, like I said, to kind of wheel it around back to where we started in this conversation. We can work on our practice in ways that makes our teaching more artistic in the context of making kids more engaged with stuff they don't really want to learn. And we can talk as long as we want about how to do those small steps and tweaks and whatever else. But at the end of the day, if our first step isn't to acknowledge the fact that we're not doing the right thing, none of it's going to matter. It's just not going to matter. No. And I don't have enough time anymore to not start there.
It's like, you and I, we've had some recently conversations where we get to the point and people look us straight in the eye and say, "I know, I'm not doing the right thing."
Right. And I've become over the last couple of years and in the work that we've done in Change School, especially has given me more capacity to just start with that question. Yeah. Because out of the 250 odd people who we've worked with in Change School, I'd say 230 of them just kind of go, "Yeah, you're right. You're right." Yep. You know, and even outside of Change School, I mean, people don't push back that hard about that truth. Where they struggle, though, is in that their own self-confidence, their own self-assessment, their own self-worth in the context of a conversation that says you need to do things in a different way. You know, that's where it gets really difficult. And that's where David Gleason, Robert Evans, you know, a lot of these people who are holding up the book, who are talking about that emotional side of it. That's where it gets really, really tough and scary. And I think that's where the work is. It's not about the 45-minute session on RTI. Sorry. That's not where we should be starting. We should be really starting with reimagining, you know, our work based on doing, as Sarrazin says, the right thing, which is starting where kids are.
And just to segue as we get to the end of this podcast, you know, back to another book we've discussed on an earlier podcast, the answer to how is yes. Mm-hmm. And we come back to that, just focus on the why. Focus, which is what you were doing in that quote from Fast Company. Why do these people believe this? because of the things we've just been discussing. That, you know, people are so focused on how do I get around this? How do I do that? You know, and distracts them, because when you talk about the shift that you were referencing in that quote from Saracen in the Artistry of Teaching post you did last week, the first thing a lot of people would automatically jump from the quote to saying to themselves, how am I going to do that? And you go, hang on. Just can we come back and focus on, do you agree with that? Could you believe that?
And one other thing,
that you'll work out the how.
That's right. One of the things I must have said 20 times this weekend in Johannesburg was, if you're passionate enough about the why, you'll figure out the how. And, you know, David made a great point, too, when he did some math, and I can't remember the number, but, you know, he estimated that in the room when he was given his keynote, there were some there in the neighborhood of, you know, 1,500 years of experience in education. And, you know, if we can't look within ourselves and find answers to questions that we care about, and that's Peter Block's message, you know,
stop,
you know, let's put a 6-month moratorium on how.
That's right.
You know, let's stop asking questions that start with how, and instead let's really get to the meat of what the why question is, and why do we exist? What's our purpose? But anyway, it's hard to get there. I mean, it's a big hairy conversation.
Well, it's a good point to wrap up, because I think hopefully what we've done is as we like to do in these podcasts and through the posts in the newsletter, is give people discussion points, provocations, questions, because that's what we need, a lot more of those. So it's yet again, great to have you back home. And
as always,
good talking with you, mate.
All right, Bruce. Cheers.
Cheers, mate.